It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Reporters from three Wisconsin news outlets are teaming up to investigate police accountability here in the state.
The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, WTMJ, and Wisconsin Watch are working together to uncover the Milwaukee County District Attorney's list of police officers it views as unreliable witnesses in court cases.
It's known as a Brady list. Prosecutors across the state have their own list to track which officers they shouldn't rely on for testimony because of past misconduct.
We're learning more about how these lists work and how these Wisconsin reporters are investigating them.
Ashley Luthern is the deputy investigations editor at the Journal Sentinel and an investigative reporter focused on public safety, crime, and policing. Ashley, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
And Rachel Moran is an associate professor at the University of St. Thomas School of Law, where she researches Brady lists and police accountability. Rachel, thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
Ashley, I gave a very brief overview, but can you tell us a little more about what these so-called Brady lists are?
Absolutely. The Brady list is a list of law enforcement officials who have been found to have lied or broken the law or acted in a way that erodes their credibility or integrity to be a witness. As you mentioned, it comes from a U.S. Supreme Court case, Brady versus Maryland. And that ruled that very generally that prosecutors can't withhold material that might help the defense at trial or exculpatory evidence. And that includes any indication that an essential witness, such as a police officer, might have credibility issues.
Rachel, can you talk a little more about why these lists exist? What was the reasoning behind that decision and how it's been implemented that Ashley was just talking about?
Yeah, so the reason these lists exist is that the Supreme Court has said, like Ashley said, in a case called Brady versus Maryland, and also in a later case called Kyles versus Whitley, that prosecutors are responsible not just for giving information to defense, but also for keeping track of the information. And the court has said that includes information within the possession of police departments or other people involved in the case. And so the prosecutors have a legal obligation to keep track of and to give defendants information that might help the defendant's case by attacking the credibility of the witness.
Rachel, how consistent are these lists? Are the record keeping on these lists from one state to another, one county to another?
Horribly inconsistent. There's really very little law other than what we just talked about telling prosecutors exactly what information they need to keep track of or exactly how they must keep track of it. And so we find just a ton of disparity across the state and even within states. Different counties operate differently. Some prosecutors don't have these lists at all, and it's unclear to me how they would keep up with their legal obligations, but they just don't keep track.
Ashley, what do you see when you look around Wisconsin as far as what Rachel was just talking about, the consistency or lack of same on these Brady lists?
What Rachel said is exactly what we are seeing. Our colleagues at Wisconsin Watch earlier this year had filed records requests with prosecutors in every county in the state. 17 denied the request or said they didn't keep track, and another 23 said they had no names on file. Earlier this year, Milwaukee County DA's office released a partial list, which included officers who had been criminally charged or convicted of a crime. However, when WTMJ4, as well as us at the Journal Sentinel and Wisconsin Watch, as we pushed and asked for the full list, they ultimately released it with the note, "We cannot, you know, guarantee the accuracy of this." And that gets to some of the inconsistency we were just talking about. Some of these names on this list have a person's name, and then it just says integrity violation. It doesn't tell us exactly what happened, what consequences that person faced, or if they're even still employed in that same department or another law enforcement agency.
And Ashley, that takes us to this current effort now, this joint effort with the Journal Sentinel and the two other organizations. What are you trying to accomplish now with this information, especially in Milwaukee County?
At a very basic level, we're trying to first verify the accuracy of the list, as I was just discussing. That's involving all of us from our partner organizations divvying up the work, filing additional public records requests to figure out what exactly landed people on this list and if they are still employed in law enforcement. as well as trying to discern how local police agencies are communicating with the prosecutors and the DA's office and what policies they have about proactively sharing information about officers who have had integrity violations or other concerns that would put their credibility in question.
We're talking about prosecutors' lists of police officers who they question their ability to testify successfully in court. These are called sometimes Brady lists or do not call lists. Our guests are Milwaukee Journal Sentinel investigative reporter Ashley Lutheran and University of St. Thomas law professor Rachel Moran. Rachel, I imagine there's a couple different audiences that might have an interest in these lists. First and foremost, their intended audience, defense attorneys and the people they represent. How forthcoming across the country are prosecutors with these lists when these lists actually exist in the first place?
There's a ton of variety there, too. And I want to be clear, I do think prosecutors are partly responsible for this. I would call it a problem, the lack of consistency. But so are judges, so are lawyers generally, for politicians, for not creating clearer guidelines. So we see just a ton of inconsistency in terms of not just what prosecutors collect, but whether they proactively give the information to defense attorneys. In some states, that's because there are different laws governing whether this information is publicly accessible. So some states say, put really just a tight hold on information about officer misconduct and say it's very hard to give access to the public. Some states say these are public servants, people should have the information, and these are open records. But those differences in laws create a lot of variety in terms of how readily prosecutors disclose the information.
And Rachel, I imagine one argument against making these publicly available is this might be an internal misconduct review or something like that. An officer might not have been charged with a crime, much less prosecuted. Is that one of the arguments that's saying, hey, this is not necessarily information the public has a right to know?
Yeah, that is one of the arguments. And I think that there's a middle ground here in the context of criminal cases where an officer is involved, which is to say, even if the public doesn't have a right to know, certainly the defense attorneys should have ready access to this information. But unfortunately, the way the laws work or the way prosecutors have interpreted them, prosecutors sometimes say, well, we don't think we can even disclose this to the defense attorneys.
Ashley, coming back to this project you're part of now, what is your goal? What information are you hoping to get, and how much are you looking to share publicly?
Our goal is to ultimately publish a database that people can publicly look at this information. We take our job of confirming the information on the list and providing as much context as possible very seriously. There are some other states and some partners on this very project who have done work in other states, reporting in other states that have led to more public disclosures of officers on these so-called Brady lists. For example, in Maricopa County, one of the reporters on this project who works for Scripps, which owns WTMJ Channel 4, his work led to Maricopa County routinely publishing updated lists of officers who are on the Brady list, I think every 2 weeks. And so our goal ultimately is to verify this information, provide a level of accountability and transparency so that the public can see this.
Ashley, what are some of the obstacles and maybe lack of transparency in certain places that's standing between you now at the outset of this project and what you just described as the final product?
I think it's a lot, as I mentioned before, going to a lot of different places and agencies for information, making sure that we are being fair as well. In other states, it has come out as reporters have examined these lists. There have certainly been instances of officers placed on the list when reporters got the underlying information. It did not make sense as to why they were on that list. So we are interested in that as well. And mainly it's an information issue. And frankly, there's also a question of access for knowing who is still in law enforcement. And that kind of gets into a separate issue, but that is something that will be difficult to ascertain and track.
Well, Rachel, that is something that people might be thinking. So wait a minute, we've got some police officers on the job who, for whatever reason, They wouldn't, their testimony wouldn't hold up in court. If people brought up their past behavior, it might be their testimony might be disqualified or at least doubted by jurors. Is there a deeper problem here if there's this roster of whatever percentage of the police force that won't hold up in court?
Yeah, thanks for asking, because that really does get to the heart of the issue. If we have officers who are lacking in credibility, you know, I think a legitimate question is, why are they still on the force, or at least why are they in positions where they're involved in criminal cases? So I think this whole Brady list discussion speaks to a bigger issue in police accountability.
Ashley, what is the timeline on this investigation until we might see this public database of officers who might be on these lists?
That is something we are still working through. I can tell you that the media partners in this project are working as efficiently as we can. But as I'm sure you know, at WPR, it takes time to get records requests back and that sort of thing. So I think optimistically, we are hoping for very early next year. You'll see ongoing coverage. We will be highlighting different cases as we get records back on specific individuals. I know WTMJ Channel 4 has aired already one or two stories related to this. We'll have more coming from the Journal Sentinel and Wisconsin Watch as well.
We'll leave it there. Ashley, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
And Rachel, thanks for being with us.
For sure. Thanks for featuring this.
We've been talking to Rachel Moran, associate professor at the University of St. Thomas School of Law, and Ashley Lutheran, reporter and deputy investigations editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Ashley is part of a multi-team media project looking at prosecutors' lists of police officers who should not be used as court witnesses and trying to share more about an investigation into that list in Milwaukee County.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, find out why two groups have filed lawsuits against Wisconsin school districts saying they are failing to protect LGBTQ plus students.
We believe that any action taken against including gender identity in Title IX is incorrect, illegal, and frankly immoral, and cannot happen.
That's coming up next on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. In recent months, several school boards across the state have been challenged because of their policies related to transgender students.
LGBTQ plus advocacy groups Fair Wisconsin and GSAFE have teamed up filing federal Title IX complaints about the school districts in question. Those districts include Winneconne, Muskego Norway, Abbotsford, Hartford Union, Kettle Moraine, and Waukesha.
I talked to representatives of the two groups filing these actions late last month. Abigail Swetz is executive director at Fair Wisconsin. Brian Jukums is senior director of education and policy at the group GSAFE. Brian, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob. Nice to be back.
And Abigail, thanks for being with us.
Really appreciate the invite.
And Abigail, let's start with you. And I want to situate this in what's going on with the latest White House ruling on Title IX and all the court cases going on. It's a little complicated. What is the current state of Title IX protections, especially when it comes to transgender students and other LGBTQ plus students?
Thank you for asking, because I think it's a little complicated for people to understand, but it's actually quite clear. The thing that we need to understand is that Title IX includes protections for LGBTQ plus students. That includes protections for students because of gender identity and gender expression, sex stereotypes, sex characteristics. That is all clarified in the current regulations that went into effect on August 1, 2024 from the Biden administration. But when I say clarified, I say it very specifically because, frankly, that was already the law in Wisconsin since 2017. The 7th District Court made it very clear in Whitaker v. Kenosha that gender identity protections are a part of Title IX.
There are court cases in many states around the country. The specific rule from the Biden administration blocked in many states right now. And of course, a change of administration could lead to a revisiting of what came through in August. Abigail, do you think that the ground may shift under this conversation over the course of the next few months?
I think there's a lot of shifting ground in general right now, but what we are absolutely steadfast in is that we believe that any action taken against including gender identity in Title IX is incorrect, illegal, and frankly immoral and cannot happen. And so our organizations, Fair Wisconsin and GSAFE, are absolutely steadfast in our commitment to our trans and non-binary students. I also just want to make it clear, not only will we not be deterred from ensuring every member of our community is protected and frankly respected, but I want you to understand that with the upcoming change in federal administration, it's true, we have received questions whether or not we will continue the work of filing federal civil rights complaints if we see anti-Title IX, anti-trans actions taking place. And the answer is yes, Title IX does protect LGBTQ plus students and staff, and we will continue filing. The other thing to keep in mind with the shifting legal landscape is that, again, it actually shows that it's less shifting than we realized, than we previously thought, because of a recent finding in the Title IX complaint against Owosso School District in Oklahoma. That finding that talked about gender identity being protected within the purview of Title IX was based on Title IX as it stood before August 1st. And again, in Wisconsin, since Whitaker v. Kenosha in 2017, it's been clear gender identity is included.
Brian, that takes us to the specific civil rights legal challenges under Title IX that your two groups have been working on in Wisconsin. They're different, possibly from district to district, but what are some of the common themes that are leading you to make these challenges?
Sure. Well, the district school boards have each fostered a hostile environment through actions taken during official school board meetings. So that includes eliminating, and Rob, we're talking literally striking out words, or excluding gender identity from the anti-discrimination policies detailing Title IX protections and or public statements during meetings, particularly from board members, and also the absence of any action taken to protect trans and non-binary students from discrimination when brought to the board's attention in meetings. As we review or as we're in person watching these meetings, it's very clear that members of the community are coming to them saying, don't do this, we need and we expect support for our trans kids. So when we think about them, these actions, they were taken with full knowledge of the potential legal ramifications that being out of compliance with federal regulations could have, as Abby talked about. You know, we saw instances of district lawyers literally explaining those potential consequences in board meetings, or other board members pointing that out. We just saw that in Watertown this past week. Although it also, we need to say that there are, you know, we've seen at least one lawyer who claimed that the Department of Education probably doesn't have the capacity to investigate if any complaints arise, but we know that's not true.
And Brian, what are some of the specific protections that are either being specifically overturned in schools or maybe absent in the first place that you find particularly concerning?
Sure. Well, when we think about what our best practices for supporting and affirming trans and non-binary students in schools, oftentimes that includes areas looking at student privacy, looking at the names and pronouns that are going to be used at school. It's also about access to segregated facilities, such as bathrooms and locker rooms, overnight accommodations on field trips, how students' names get read at graduation, who's included in the classroom curriculum, and so on. You know, if we take Watertown as an example, two of the things that were most egregious in our eyes, one was their decision in their new quote-unquote gender guidance policy or gender support plan was to ban trans youth from using bathrooms that align with their gender identity. And this is very blatant discrimination and contrary to the Seventh Circuit Court ruling from 2017, the Whitaker versus Kenosha case, which really opens up the district or really any district that might follow Watertown's lead to an immediate lawsuit. It also leaves it up to individual staff to determine what name and pronouns they will use when referring to trans students. That also was very concerning to us because basically what they're saying is, well, you could use a student's name, but you don't have to. And what we know that happens is that when a student isn't consistently affirmed or name isn't used in a consistent way, that stands to out students on a regular basis to their peers. When an educator who's trusted to create a safe space for a student doesn't use the name that affirms the student and that the student uses, that gives permission to other students and other families that it's okay not to respect our students. So those two items in particular were of deep concern to us, at least in the Watertown case. And we see similar efforts being made in other school districts.
Abigail, can you talk about transgender and other students who might experience some of the things Brian just listed? What are your concerns about the potential harm for them?
Thanks for asking that question, because I think it's very easy to think of this only as policy, but we are talking about something that really impacts people on a day-to-day basis, these students, these staff who are trans, who are non-binary, and frankly, all the kids and all the staff who are listening to us make these arguments and sometimes listening to school board members who are saying really transphobic and hateful things. We have to remember that everyone is listening when we have these conversations and our children are learning from it. So one of the things that I think Brian just so eloquently put, and I'll really double down on, is that consistency really matters here. And so when we look at the studies that talk about the mental health and well-being of all our students, and including our trans and non-binary students, it really does show that the consistency of using the name and pronouns that a student has asked for absolutely buttresses their mental health and well-being in a really positive way in as many environments as possible. That includes school, that includes home, that includes the community. And so really all of us can play a part in affirming the young people in our lives and respecting the identities that they present us with. I'll also say that the Youth Risk Behavior Survey that is done through the CDC and DPI every other year, there was a UW researcher who recently analyzed some of the data from the last survey about trans youth. And one of the things that they found is that trans youth are more likely to go to a school professional with concerns for their mental health than other youth, than LGB youth or than cisgender or straight youth. And so knowing that trans youth are more likely to turn to a school professional and yet also do it at a very low rate, I think it's important that we make sure that our schools are these safe spaces.
We're talking about Title IX complaints against Wisconsin school boards with Abigail Swetz with Fair Wisconsin and Brian Jukums with the group G-Safe. I want to take a look at some of the arguments that people have made when it comes to some of these transgender protections, arguments against them. Brian, one thing we hear at a lot of the school board meetings we're talking about relates to pronoun changes, name changes for kids, especially at the elementary school and middle school level, and whether school staff have to notify parents. I could see, and we see parents saying, well, hang on, this is a big thing for my kid. Of course I would want to be notified. And part of this conversation, what would be wrong, Brian, with the policy saying, yeah, the school does have to let that parent know?
Well, one thing, Rob, is that it's a one-size-fits-all approach to students who are very different from each other, and every student brings their own unique experiences, as well as every family. So, what we know is that for over 20 years, schools in Wisconsin have been developing best practices around how do we bring families into oftentimes what can be really scary and challenging conversations with their children. Good policy that I've seen in other school districts point the school towards working to bring families into the conversation as soon as possible. We know that that's really important to the child's journey, but we have to do that in ways where the student feels safe and ready to have that conversation, and also make sure that the family who might just be starting a journey around their child's identity with that conversation, we want to make sure that that family has support as well, right, and has the resources that we need. If the approach is to just throw a child off the cliff and just hope that things go well for them, we know it doesn't go well, and we don't equip families to understand how to create the support that they need. And if I could circle back really quickly to your question about harm that you asked, Abby, we often talk about these policies as harming trans kids, which they do, but what we know is that they harm all children. I think about the very first family that I worked with about 20 years ago in my role at GSafe, and it was a family near Watertown whose straight, cisgender, white son was bullied out of school because he didn't act like the right kind of boy, and his peers picked up on that and teased him with homophobic and transphobic terms, and he left his school district because he didn't feel safe. So people advocating for these policies think that it's just about trans kids, but it could very easily be their kid next who gets targeted and isn't protected.
Abigail, another concern that gets brought up, and this was brought up in comments in the Watertown School District. A teen girl said she didn't feel comfortable at school. She worried that transgender-related policies on bathrooms would allow boys to claim they were transgender, go into girls' bathrooms. She felt potentially threatened by that. Again, this is something that comes up again and again in these school board conversations. What do you say to people with those concerns?
I think we have to meet people with any concern, really, where they're at with that concern. And so I'll meet it at a safety level. I 100% understand that sometimes things that we don't know a lot about, like, for example, someone else's transgender or non-binary identity, can feel a little scary, maybe even a little threatening. And what we have to keep in mind is that these are people who have their own privacy concerns as well. And that, frankly, going to the bathroom is a vulnerable situation for everyone and is usually far more unsafe and vulnerable for the trans or non-binary person than anyone else. And so creating that safety and creating that privacy and respect for someone who is one of the most marginalized identities in our country can really create safety for everyone. I'll also add that I know in the past there's been a lot of, even in Wisconsin, discussion around bathroom bills, which in some ways this kind of is, but at a school board level. And a lot of the things that have been really problematic about discussions about access to things like bathrooms has to do with how would one know such things without potentially outing someone or potentially really invasive questions. And I think we really need to make sure that we are respecting everyone's privacy. So I understand that not everyone has a lot of context when it comes to trans and non-binary identity. And it's something that we all definitely need to continue to learn about and listen to the people who are most impacted by these policies, and that is our trans and non-binary students. To which I'd actually just like to add a point. I'm a member of the LGBTQ plus community. I am not trans or non-binary, and I think it's really important that we always center trans and non-binary voices in these conversations. I also think it's really important that all of us stand up as really strong allies so that those people do not always have to be in the position of defending their own existence. And so Brian and I are here as very strong, strong supporters, but I just want to say that, of course, we need to always be listening to those most impacted as well.
And Brian, you've mentioned you've been working on gender issues related to schools for quite some time now. How have you seen both opinions and discussions and then rules about transgender students change, evolve over the years?
Sure. Well, you know, Rob, one of the things that we have to remember is that in Wisconsin, we don't have statewide protections for our transgender students and community members, right? We have statewide protections based on sexual orientation, but not gender identity. So what I've seen over the last 20 years is that I've seen school districts across Wisconsin, both large and small, conservative and progressive, all corners of the state, work to pass policies that are inclusive and affirming of trans and non-binary students and working to create guidance around how to implement that on the day-to-day basis, including in Waukesha, which, you know, until recently had, you know, people, I think, assumed that Waukesha wouldn't be a supportive school district. But what I've seen is good administrators and many educators and many families working to create safe spaces for our trans and non-binary students, although that recently changed with a new administrator and a new school board. So I'm definitely seeing good progress that many school districts have made over the past 20 years. I see that's starting to slide, but I also see a recommitment from educators, from really engaged parents and community members, as well as students pushing back and asserting their right to feel safe and have access to a quality public education.
Abigail, what would you say to a school administrator and a school board who are not currently at the center of one of these lawsuits? They're considering their policies related to gender identity. They may feel pressure from various quarters in their local community, maybe getting online pressure from around the country, maybe even around the world. How can they sit down, craft policies that work, that pass legal muster in the midst of the heat that surrounds that kind of pressure?
I appreciate that question because, frankly, I really hope that the people who are trying to consider how to do really great policy reach out to GSAFE and Fair Wisconsin, because we are organizations that are ready to help with that. GSAFE does incredible work in the form of training in terms of best practices. We, as Fair Wisconsin and also GSAFE together, can really help administrators and school boards in figuring out how to make sure their communities really understand the importance of these affirming policies for all children to be able to access a high quality education. So GSAFE and Fair Wisconsin are here to help with that endeavor. We understand that it is a difficult political situation, but we also want to make sure that everyone is really heard and seen and listened to. And we are organizations that are really well versed in figuring out how to make that happen and for affirming policies to be the outcome of that conversation.
And Brian, with the lawsuits against about a half dozen districts now at this point, what is the timeline? When are we going to start seeing things coming out of courts on this, do you think?
Sure. Well, Rob, one of the things that's important to know is that one of the Title IX complaints, our first Title IX complaint that we filed with the Office of Civil Rights, actually got picked up this past week against the Kettle Moraine School District. So, and again, that was the first complaint that we filed, and we have several more complaints that we have filed or plan to file. So we do still expect the department to be looking at and taking up our complaints. We also know that, you know, that is a process and that might take some time, but it doesn't have to take a lot of time. What we know is that each of these school districts where we filed complaints or other school districts that have considered taking similar motions, they can take another vote and vote to adopt the Title IX guidance as written and affirm that trans and queer students have a valuable and important and protected space in their school community.
We'll leave it there. Brian, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
And Abigail, thanks for being with us.
Of course.
That was Abigail Swetz, Executive Director at Fair Wisconsin, and Brian Jukums, Senior Director of Education and Policy at the group GSAFE. We talked about Title IX complaints that they filed against several school boards across Wisconsin.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, hundreds of Wisconsin folk tunes are now archived by the Library of Congress with recordings dating back to the 1930s.
It was kind of a, you know, a bold and visionary deed by these song collectors to capture the whole.
It's the Wisconsin Folk Song Collection on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're hearing Alte Uhr by Hans Huber, one of the nearly 900 folk tunes from Wisconsin that are now part of the National Recording Registry at the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C.
The songs in the collection were recorded between 1937 and 1946. They offer a snapshot of our state's oral and musical traditions of the time.
What does the collection teach us about the people of Wisconsin? We have folklorist Jim Leary, professor emeritus of folklore and Scandinavian studies at UW-Madison, and author of the book Folk Songs of Another America. Also with us is Nikki Saylor, director of the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress and a former student of Jim's. Jim, Nikki, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Yes, thank you so much. Happy to be here.
Jim, I want to start with you. You've said that this collection of Wisconsin folk songs is the most diverse and equitable and inclusive folk song field collection ever made for the Library of Congress. What makes it so distinctive?
Well, in the first half of the 20th century, when a lot of the field recording was launched under the auspices of the Library of Congress, there was very much an emphasis on English language songs of mostly Anglo-Americans and African-Americans, a lot of it in the East, the South, and a little bit into the West. But there wasn't really much attention to all of the diverse languages and songs of immigrant peoples. And American Indian songs were also kind of siloed away, the work of certain anthropologists and ethnomusicologists. But the Wisconsin Folk Song Collection brought all of that together, and it also did it at a period when there was there were ongoing attempts to downplay the pluralism of America, to kind of force assimilation and attack diverse languages. And so it was kind of a bold and visionary deed by these song collectors to get capture the whole.
So breaking down some silos in music, Nikki, you know, with hundreds of recordings now archived in the National Recording Registry, what impact does that have on documenting Wisconsin music through the ages and the stories of our state?
Well, I'm really excited to see this collection get this kind of national attention. You know, Jim and I have worked with it and known about it for a very long time. And we know how unique it is and how special it is. And so for the National Registry to include it means that just a lot of other people are going to get exposed to the music. And the fact that the Mills Music Library has it online makes it even better. So people can just listen and hear a wide breadth of recordings.
So do other states contribute collections like Wisconsin's in the National Recording Registry?
The registry has recordings from all over the place. At the American Folklife Center, we are what's called an ethnographic archives. And so a lot of what we have are field workers like Helene Stratman Thomas and Sidney Robertson Cowell, who went out and recorded people in their communities singing the songs that they sing, telling the stories that they tell in their communities. And then and sometimes they would take pictures. So there's some pictures of the Wisconsin Historical Society of some of these performers. And so these ethnographic materials are then, you know, donated to our archives for, you know, safekeeping and preservation and access.
Do you have a specific idea of what constitutes, quote unquote, folk music?
There's been a lot of debate about that over the years. But fundamentally, it's music that's rooted in some kind of culture or a mixture of cultures in a region, and it happens in an informal way at the grassroots level. But of course, in our wild and crazy world with migration and sound recordings and mass media, you have all sorts of mixtures and that sort of thing. But it's fundamentally kind of the grassroots music that happens, the musical vernacular of distinctive locales and cultural groups.
Nikki, it sounds like that question perhaps has been debated in classrooms many moons ago for a long time.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, let's listen to part of a song here from the collection. This is L'America è tanto bella. So what I understand, Jim, is that it is sung in Italian by Mr. Thomas St. Angelo, recorded right around August 9th, 1946, near Cumberland, Wisconsin. What else can you tell us?
Well, in the Cumberland area is the largest rural Italian settlement in the United States. Immigrants from Abruzzo and Molise came to work there in the late 1880s, and Tom St. Angelo, as well as Ambrose DiGidio and two other singers who were on this recording, were children of those immigrants. And it's an immigrant song. It's America is so beautiful. Italy is so small. it's a man saying, you know, I'm off to America, I won't return. And then there's a second verse, subsequent verses, where a young woman who's in Italy says, "Mother, give me my dowry. I'm going to America. We won't see Italy anymore." And it's obviously it's one of the many songs of immigration.
Yeah, I mean, it was recorded a year after the end of World War II, so America is emerging as this economic powerhouse, political powerhouse. You know, how can we view this folk tune in the context of larger events in history?
Yeah, these recordings were made from the late 30s, and then there was a little hiatus during wartime because of restrictions, and then again recorded in 46. And many of the people who sang for, especially for Helene Stratman Thomas, were descendants of countries that had been occupied by the Nazis. And so there were, you know, there were Norwegians and Dutch and French people and Belgians. And you know, they invested some of their songs, I think, with, you know, a powerful sense of love for their home country, the country of origin, but also pride in being in the United States. And you know, it's a kind of a little snapshot, I think, of how it's possible for people to love their homeland, but also to be thoroughly Americans without denying their roots.
We're talking about Wisconsin's folk music roots with Jim Leary there, Professor Emeritus of Folk Life at UW-Madison. And Nikki Saylor is here, Director of the American Folk Life Center at the Library of Congress. We asked WPR's host of the show, Simply Folk, Sheila Shigley, if collections like this one might be important outside of the academic arena. And here's what Sheila had to say.
Those of us who perform folk music, who love folk music, who spend a lot of time in it, we want to hear what was going on in the past. These are the roots. They're the source. It's so full of exciting things that you didn't realize were exciting until you go back in time and listen to a recording from, say, 60 years ago and hear just the amazing quality of that musicianship. And by musicianship, I'm talking about the heart.
Talking about the heart, Nikki, how do you reflect on the heart of this music?
I think the heart of the music is really evident. And, you know, not only do people who appreciate folk music want to go back and listen to these recordings, but family members want to go back. So, you know, we'll have next of kin for recordings such as this come into our research center at the library and want to, you know, hear these original recordings. It means a lot to them personally and to their community.
We're going to hear another song from the collection. This is part of a tune called Lullaby. It's performed by Margaret Eagle, also known as Laughing Eyes in the Zuni language. Jim, what can you tell us about this lullaby?
Well, this is a song that was sung by a woman from Zuni Pueblo and was an internal migrant of sorts in 1933. In Chicago, the Century of Progress, a World's Fair was happening, and they had a number of so-called Indian villages, bringing together people from the woodlands and the plains and the Southwest. And that brought together Ho-Chunk, or Winnebago people, as they were known, in Chicago, along with Margaret Eagle. And since the 1920s in Wisconsin Dells, there had been at Stand Rock, first some powwows, and then eventually the Stand Rock ceremonial. And Margaret Eagle went to sing there from 1933 to 1972. A lullaby, of course. Lullaby is a genre that's found, you know, throughout the world in so many languages and cultures. You know, beautiful songs for children, and this is a great example. And Margaret Eagle was actually, her name is Idaki, and she was one of a number of singers recorded in 1946 in the Dells that included some Oglala Sioux, but mostly Ho-Chunk singers.
I wonder, were there other first-person primary source interviews with her?
There was an ethnomusicologist named Charles Hoffman who did field work all that summer of 46, and he recorded about a dozen songs with her. And Nikki spoke earlier about relatives, descendants of singers seeking recordings from the Library of Congress. Margaret Eagle's grandson, Fabian Fontanelle Zuni, and his wife, Shelley Morningsong, had known about this singing but had never heard it, and were able to get a CD sent by the Library of Congress with 12 songs, and they themselves are performers and put out a record maybe about 6 or 7 years ago that includes a little commemoration of this Margaret Idaki, or Margaret Eagle, as she was known.
It's so wonderful to hear how bits and pieces of this history are preserved, and they come together as the future generations want to preserve it as well.
You know, every place in the country is in its own way the center of the world. But when one looks at generalizations or popular conceptions about what constitutes American folk music, you know, nobody would think of, you know, the descendants of Italian immigrants in rural Wisconsin, or Welsh singers in rural Wisconsin, or a Zuni internal migrant to southern Wisconsin. People are looking, you know, to the southern Appalachia or the Mississippi Delta or something like that, or to cowboy songs. But, you know, there's plenty going on in many, many parts of the country. And I think that it's really important to champion of a broader and more diverse, equitable, and inclusive notion of what constitutes the folk music of Americans.
Jim and Nikki, thank you so much for sharing this folk music heritage with us.
Well, it's been a treat.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
That was UW-Madison Professor Emeritus and folklorist Jim Leary, and Nikki Saylor, Director of the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress. We're hearing Pik Shotisha, played by Otto Rinzlisbacher on the violin.
Yesterday, we heard about a collection of letters sent home to Wisconsin from a World War II service member, and we invited you to share your letter-writing stories.
Karen in Western Wisconsin is a big fan of letter-writing. Karen shares, "After my sister died last year, I received items from her house, and among them was a large collection of letters that my parents wrote to each other. My dad was in the Navy on a ship in the Pacific, and I think my mother saved every letter he wrote home to her. I know he wasn't able to save all of her letters to bring home, but there were some. It's really interesting experience to read through them."
And Karen says, "I do really enjoy receiving letters as well, but the number of people that will still write a response to a letter are becoming a shrinking part of the population. Karen says it seems like everybody wants to text or email instead.
If you're a fan of writing and receiving letters, we'd still love to hear from you. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org or call or text us at 888-642-0232.
I might write more letters. The trouble is my writing is so bad, nobody can actually read them.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is WPR News.